Rob, Andy D's back for episode 5, Paleolithic Solution. How are you today, man?
Oh, dude, good. Nobody has sniper shot me nor cut the cables on my car, my brake cables yet, so I'm good to go.
Well, I'm staring at an enormous Americano, and so I think I'm perfect, you know?
I'm hoping that that's not like some sort of a Latin lover sort of thing. I hope this podcast isn't you coming out of the closet.
It is explicit, Rob. We clarified that for the listeners, so.
I'm even going to try to rein myself in too. I'll try to rein that in so we can get a PG-13 rating at some point. So.
We actually have the ability to possibly change that, Rob. I'm just get concerned that someday you're gonna go on a rant against your hatred for dairy or something, and then, if we're gonna get someone yelling at us about swearing and ruining their kids' ears, and so, I just figure we should warn people ahead of time.
It's probably a good idea, whether it's explicit or not, just in case. So,
That's right.
yeah.
Always be prepared, like the Boy Scouts.
Right.
All right, so we got some really good questions today. Also want to remind folks that if you like the podcast, please go to iTunes, give us a ranking, give us a review. I think we've got about 10 people that posted reviews, which is super helpful and appreciate that. So if we don't make you too miserable, please add some nice words of encouragement because it's a lot of work to get Rob to talk. I mean, as you can tell.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Right, cool. Well, we got two related questions about dairy. So I think I'm going to read both of them and kind of go through them together, Rob, if that makes sense, rather than answering them individually because I think they're interrelated.
Totally, yeah, sounds good.
So we got an email question from Greg, and he wanted to clarify the role of milk in relation to the paleo diet. Versus consumption for mass gain and the physical side effects of dairy products. Also, any thoughts on the benefits of raw milk would be helpful. And then Anthony has a related question asking us to talk about the paleo-ness of dairy, specifically little to zero carb foods like butter, cheese. I think we might also add heavy cream to that discussion. And then he's also curious about the general recommendation of milk consumption related to CrossFit football. Do the muscle building benefits outweigh leaky gut symptoms and giant insulin spikes?
From lactose.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a key point to look at. Okay, so gee whiz, the role of dairy in relation to the paleo diet. Obviously dairy is a Neolithic food, but it also has stunning growth promoting properties. It typically contains protein, carbohydrate, and fat, so it's calorically dense, nutrient dense. It has this wacky characteristic, which I guess kind of addresses something in the second question, of a huge, huge, inordinately large insulin spike. And not just insulin like growth factor, growth hormone, epithelial growth factor. Professor Cordain talked about the fact that, both dairy and, say, meat-derived proteins increase IGF-1, but something that dairy does is that it blocks a ligand for a muscle protein, insulin-like growth factor protein 3, I believe, is the ligand for that, and it blocks that. And what this does is it actually makes the whole process even more anabolic, but far above and beyond what just meat does. So the bottom line is that dairy is massively growth promoting. It literally flips on the growth or replication switch in like virtually every cell in your body, which for bodybuilding, muscle building, that sounds great. If you happen to have breast, colon, or prostate cells and you're worried about any of that stuff turning into cancer, it could be not so great. And there's some really telling information about like dairy consumption, particularly early dairy consumption, increasing the rates of cancer and whatnot. But it's something that Wellborn has talked about. This is, you see kids, or we'll just focus on the kids, we'll focus on the Wellborn example. You see these kids who want to play football, high school football, college football, and they want to get big, they want to put on mass, and these kids end up going on just the junk food, seafood diet, and they're eating horrible quality food. Kids in high school weighing upwards of 300 pounds. It took Wellborn into his late college, early NFL career to get to 300 pounds. And this was 300 pounds at like 8% body fat, you know, 38 to 42 inch vertical leap, amazing, you know, metrics in the gym and all that. These kids are just looking at the scale weight. The football coaches are just looking at the scale weight. And these kids are getting enormous, but, you know, upwards of 50 to 60% body fat. Like, they're effectively morbidly obese. And then these kids end up getting done with school and they've developed eating habits that are absolutely abysmal. So John's idea here is that, you know, a paleo plus dairy approach could be huge for helping promote mass gain. And he's seen that play out with the, you know, the thousands of people that are following the CrossFit football site and the people that are experimenting with that. So it's very, very, very effective for increasing lean body mass while minimizing, in my opinion, the likelihood of some sort of collateral damage with high insulin levels from just crap food. But the question is, are there any other side effects to it? And we really don't know. For sure, your likelihood of acne is much worse. Sleep apnea, you know, sleep disturbances, any of the hyperinsulinemia issues are pretty high on the dairy consumption, and it's a dose response curve. I had somebody just ask me, you know, is a quart or a gallon okay for you know, mass gain? And I'm like, Christ, man, you know, what do you want to do? Like, do you want it all on, or do you want to sneak up on it? What are your ultimate goals? So there's just trade-offs with this. It's an economic trade-off. There's cost-benefit with all that stuff.
Before we maybe just to interject, I want to talk about, I guess, raw milk, and maybe this is a time, too, to kind of throw in if you have any different perspective on goat's milk versus cow's milk.
You know, the goat's milk, one point I want to make really clear is that tons and tons of people think that it's the lactose that causes the bulk of the insulin spike. Lactose is synergistic in that, but the proteins alone cause an insulin release. And this is kind of the, you know, somewhat unique feature of dairy, is that it causes a very powerful insulin release, but very, very little glucagon release. So you're not really getting all that great of a control in that regard. Now, the raw milk, if it's grass-fed, may be pretty damn good from the standpoint that it has significant amounts of omega-3s in it. It has conjugated linoleic acid, which is actually muscle-promoting and anti-tumor agent and all this stuff. It's a great, great nutritional supplement. It also has a ton of alpha-lipoic acid in it, fat-soluble, water-soluble antioxidant, enhances liver function. So grass-fed dairy, just like grass-fed meat, is just like infinitely more nutritious. It doesn't have the problem of containing a significant amount of grain lectins, largely just corn-derived lectins, because that's what we tend to feed our dairy cattle. So it's all better from that regard, but it still has a real potent insulin spike. So folks need to weigh whether or not, you know, that's a benefit to them. The goat's milk, I find that I just tolerate a little bit better. The analysis that Lauren Cordain and Pedro Bastos have sent to me is that it's effectively the same with regards to growth-promoting properties. Like, dairy is dairy. But there are obviously a little bit of differences with them. People will digest, you know, the proteins and whatnot a little bit differently. I find that I can handle goat's dairy a little bit better than regular cow dairy when I've experimented with that stuff. Like, I did a mass gain last year and did a significant amount of goat's milk. So,
now, continuing on that line of thought, you want to share perspective perhaps on cheese compared to milk, and then also I think butter and some of the heavy cream stuff.
Yeah, so cheese ends up having the bulk of the, depending on how the cheese is prepared, usually the bulk of the carbohydrate is actually removed out of it, and you've just kind of got protein and fat. Hard cheeses, I think, being more the protein form, usually a little lower fat, or maybe the fat's been removed. But fundamentally, cheese still has a very, very potent insulin spike, and from an acid-base balance, cheese is very, very net acid yielding. So if you're concerned about like acid-base balance, and ironically, if you're concerned about like bone mineral health, cheese isn't all that good of a option. It has a lot of calcium in it, but you end up actually behind the curve because it's more acid yielding than what you get calcium out of it. So that's kind of a problem. Now, foods like butter and whole whipping cream and stuff like that, if you are an individual that has no autoimmune diseases, then you'd probably be okay with that stuff. Those items, butter and cream, because they have virtually no carbohydrate or protein content, from the dairy. They're not going to really be insulin spiking. So you should be okay in that regard. But here again, like if you can track down a grass-fed source, I would say grass-fed butter, like even though, you know, I'm pretty paleoed out, if you had access to legitimate pastured or grass-fed butter, I'd be pretty fired up about that. I would use that on a consistent basis. Butyric acid is very, very healing to the gut and does some interesting stuff to the gut flora. You get way more of that in the grass-fed dairy. And then also, again, you get the conjugated linoleic acid, alpha-lipoic acid, all that sort of stuff. So that's kind of how I would approach all that, Jive. If you have an autoimmune disease, then I really would avoid dairy of any kind completely, as well as obviously grains, legumes, and even eggs.
And so I think what we typically see from folks that are playing around with this, I guess my personal experience is in most cases, with the exception of the people that are bulking up for a specific sport, you know, we're having a bit of a compromise there, right? You got a 180-pound kid that wants to play offensive line. We're going to need to do some stuff to put some weight on him. But we'll see folks in the gym that will start messing around with, you know, some of the milk stuff post-workout to help with some bulking. But we typically don't, I'll use the word advise lightly, them to try that until they've sort of achieved their desired level of leanness.
Yeah, there's no doubt that if you lean people out first, that the hormonal response that they get from exercise, from their food, is totally different than what it is when people are heavy. And typically this isn't a female issue, so I'm just going to address men on this thing. Typically if we get men below 10% body fat, then the nutrient partitioning that we see in these individuals is much, much better. We have a tendency to see much better hormonal response with, you know, flowing into muscle gain versus fat gain when we start getting hypercaloric. John Berardi, I think in his old Appetite for Construction series, had touched on that fact, or maybe it was some follow-up stuff, but he had some pretty good data on that. And just observationally, I've seen that in the folks that we've worked with myself, and then just talking with other strength coaches, that, you know, you want to get people ideally fairly lean before starting a mass gain protocol, because you're just going to get more mileage out of it. You're going to get less fat and more muscle, and really that's what you ultimately want to get. So,
yeah, and I think this is just another good opportunity to throw out there, you know, folks need to think about what their goals are with regards to their training, their nutritional approach. All these things have sort of, as you pointed out, economic trade-offs depending on what's the main goal we're trying to get to, the end state. So, you know, I think it's hard to answer these black, white, yes, dairy is good, yes, it's bad. It's sort of, well, it really depends. I guess in a perfect world, I would probably advise against dairy, but I think that depends on what your goals are, what your situation is. Do you have any autoimmune situations going on? All those things are factors that I think need to be carefully considered when either messing with dairy yourself or recommending it to your clients.
Yeah, totally. And you know, I really try to hang my hat on the basic, you know, paleo concepts and all that. But then the reality is olive oil is not technically paleo, you know, if you really want to get geeked out on it. And this is where I think people get all freaked out on this. There have been people, thoughts along this line that, well, salt, you know, paleo says not to eat salt. So, you know, paleo pseudoscience and this, that, and the other. And it's just kind of ridiculous. It's like, let's take the best that this technology has to offer and use that to guide our endeavors to the best of our ability. But then if there are things, you know, like running water is not paleo, you know, indoor plumbing is not paleo, but I, by God, I like indoor plumbing and, you know, like a good commode at home and all that. So, it's not a thing of trying to create some sort of a cult or a religion out of this stuff, but trying to find, okay, what are the trade-offs? And again, and this is where when Art Devaney's stuff was new and not quite as weird as what it's turned into, but he really did some fantastic work discussing the economic trade-offs of everything. You know, it's like, yeah, you can gain muscle mass, but there may be some trade-offs to that. And just be aware of that. And the economics of your physiology and your genetics and all that. And this is something that people just need to really drill in, because they just kind of willy-nilly make decisions and they really have no guiding, they don't know what they're doing. And so they can't really assess like what the effects of what they're doing are going to be.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know why that reminds me of the old Dr. Ken Leisner stuff, where he'd always talk about some of his clients that, you know, whatever, they had 16-inch arms at 250, but they wanted 16-inch arms when they, you know, leaned down to 205 and couldn't wrap their head around it, that, you know, oh, maybe the fact that you weighed, you know, 45 more pounds increased, you know, your overall muscle mass in addition to fat mass, and that, you know, if you wanted arms that big, you're going to have to stick maybe at 250. That's, you know, your genetic limitations.
Right. I remember Dr. Ken. He's legit.
Good old Dr. Ken. Anyway, okay, cool. So anything else you want to add to dairy? I think we kind of beat that to death, but
I think that's it. And, you know, it's again, you know, the first podcast was on post-workout nutrition. So obviously, if you're going to use dairy, post-workout is kind of the preferred time to use it. And then be clear about what the heck you're up to. You know, the dairy is a really powerful tool. And use it to your best benefit and be smart about it. And again, if you do use it, try to focus on some quality, like get the best stuff you can. I think even Costco has some Clover dairy, you know, like Clover milk and all that. So it's essentially grass-fed milk. It even is a little bit orange looking because of the carotenoids in it and all that. So use it smart, use it at the right time, post-workout, and then just be clear about what the heck you're up to with it.
Yeah. And then as a butter plug, Trader Joe's Kerrygold butter is fantastic.
Is that stuff pastured? Is it a pastured?
So I believe it is. How it was explained to me via some folks that were doing some research related to the whole, you know, cattle industry and stuff is I believe that's Irish butter. And so
Okay.
theoretically, Ireland is run much like, you know, Australia, New Zealand. Everything is, you know, all the cows are grass-fed, et cetera, et cetera. So that's my understanding. I don't notice any of the same kind of wacky side effects that I do if I use other brands of butter. So it could just be it's prepared slightly different, or it may actually be, you know, legit grass-fed, all that good stuff.
Cool. Now, what's the name of it again?
Kerrygold. So it's
Careful.
Kerrygold.
Cool. Okay.
And they have it in salted and unsalted. I've never tried the salted, but the unsalted is super yummy.
Okay.
So, give that a shot. Mileage may vary, as I say.
Cool.
All right. Next, we got an interesting question from Troy, basically talking about for those who have access to self-monitoring, what blood glucose levels and in what ranges she'll be looking for in our clients who do monitor them but may not be a diabetic. And also wants to know, is there any difference to the ranges we'd be looking on whether or not they're on a paleo diet? He basically says he has some folks that have switched to the paleo diet and they've tested their blood glucose levels and they are between upper 90s and low 100s. And basically, you know, most diabetic websites list 90 to 110 as normal, but wanted to get your perspective as we all know that being borderline isn't necessarily the same as having normal ratings.
You know, the folks that we've seen, the clients that we've tracked, we see them significantly lower than like that lower edge of 90. I think it's like millimoles per deciliter, I think. I forget exactly what the units are on it, but you know, 90 to 110 is kind of that standard lab value. If I see people 90 or 100, unless if they've been working out, you can see elevated. If they've been driving or stressed, they can be elevated. So, I mean, to some degree, you need to factor in when are they monitoring their blood glucose levels. This is where an A1C test, HbA1c, is the glycated hemoglobin is more telling of the blood glucose levels over time. Just a general, you know, look at your blood glucose levels from moment to moment isn't really going to tell you all that much. All that said, we usually see our clients just kind of cruising around if they're well adapted and insulin sensitive. Their blood glucose levels are going to be more like 60 or 70, which normally this would be some sort of like kind of like diabetic coma setting in after somebody has taken too big of an insulin bolus and their blood glucose is dropping. I operate on that lower end. Most of our clients who have adapted to this operate that way. The people who've shot in information from the website. That's where they tend to operate. So when you're more insulin sensitive, you're able to use more fat for it essentially as either fat directly or as ketone bodies for fuel. And so you just necessitate a lower blood glucose level because you don't have as much of your tissue running on it. I would again probably look more at like the A1C. If you really wanted to help your folks, I would have them check out their A1C maybe once every 2 or 3 months and having low numbers on that. You know, like the lower the better, really, on that. That's just a direct indicator of how much sugar is glycating or sticking to your body's proteins. They look at the red blood cells, but this is happening in every protein in your body. And a significant amount of aging is related directly to advanced glycation end products, the sticking of sugar to your body's proteins. So this blood glucose monitoring is okay. If you wanted to really help people, though, I would focus more on the A1C. It's going to give you a more clear picture of what is really going on with the person's health. Interestingly, the American Diabetic Association is moving away from oral glucose tolerance tests, seeing how people respond to glucose, and looking at the A1C. Interesting to that, because it's more telling about where the person's health really is. When I did a post a couple of months ago, maybe almost a year ago, on gestational diabetes, I suggested that the whole diagnostic criteria for gestational diabetes should be changed to the A1C. So I feel like I was a trendsetter on all that. So
kudos to you, Rob.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I think in general, I guess, you know, once again, we're talking really in generalities here, but on most of the kind of diagnostic numbers that we've seen thrown out by various associations, you know, most of our folks are typically well below what's considered normal on most of the criteria that I can think of.
Yeah. And, you know, as time goes on and like our population gets sicker and sicker from, you know, bad food and bad lifestyle, what counts as normal is just a statistical snapshot of who's walking through the door. So if everybody who's coming through the door is like sick, then normal really doesn't tell you anything. I mean, it tells you nothing at all. And it lulls your doctor, it lulls, you know, pharmacists, all these people into kind of a state of complacency, because it's kind of like, well, everybody's sick, so this is just normal, this is the normal course of things, and it's simply not true. All this degenerative disease, all this stuff is 100% preventable. But
Rob Wolf.
Holy cats.
You're back.
Okay. I don't know what happened.
I got really nervous there for a minute, but I think we're all right.
Yeah, I thought the rendition squad had rolled through the you know, the basement and up into the house to carry us away, but apparently not yet.
It's just good cable service, Rob. Don't be nervous.
That's weird. We've never had that before. Sorry about that. So
that's all right. I will forgive you.
Okay, excellent. So where did I drop off? I was blathering on about normal lab values that are
not... The last thing we heard was the preventability of these diseases.
All this stuff is preventable, you know, but we're hanging our hat on bad lab values, and it kind of lulls us into a sense of complacency frequently, our doctors and other healthcare practitioners.
Yes. Well said. Cool.
Cool.
All right, and then the next question, I think we covered this a little bit before, but I think it's probably good to just revisit it one more time. So during the first podcast, we mentioned the temporary drop in performance that comes with the transition to a paleo or zone diet. Would you advocate a deliberate transition period? If so, how would you implement it? Patrick goes on to say, he can see the benefit for everyone, from trainers looking to keep their clients to sedentary, albeit busy, professionals who can't see their performance drop off while their metabolic machinery acclimates. But is the benefit of getting to your endpoint faster that overwhelming? Thanks a lot, and keep it up.
This, again, is, I think so many of these questions need to be couched from where is, you know, who is the person, where are they at when they walk through your door and they start working with you? You know, this is kind of assuming working with someone new. If the person is really significantly overweight and metabolically deranged, it's going to be a hell of a transition for them, and they're going to feel like hell. It's just going to be a really rough deal. If somebody's already generally pretty athletic and eating well and more or less insulin sensitive, they'll probably not be that rough of a transition for them. But even then, we've seen people that are very athletic, you know, kind of endurance athlete sort of thing comes to mind, that they've just eaten all carbs all the time, inadequate protein, inadequate fat, but they may be running pretty lean because of genetics and activity level. But the transition is also going to be rough for them. It really kind of depends on what type of person you have. Like, are they okay with ripping the Band-Aid off all at once, or do they just want to peel it off a little bit at a time? So you can do a, you know, either all at once or an incremental approach. And then also with regards to the performance, this is that monkey, you know, the hand in the jar thing again. If it's super compelling that you not see a significant slump in your performance, if you're actually competing at something, then maybe that's okay. But Matt Lalonde's example is perfect in that he switched his nutrition, saw a significant downturn on his performance initially, didn't feel good, but sucked it up and just dealt with it. And then a month later, he was crushing everything and putting PRs up on everything from strength to metabolic conditioning. So people need to be willing to just change gears. This is part of our problem of a lack of periodization in the kind of CrossFit scene. We never end up changing gears and focusing on those deficient elements. So if somebody is insulin resistant, if they are overweight, the best thing that they can do is get lean. And if they suck for a month or 2 months because they're low carb and they're shifting their metabolic machinery, that doesn't matter, because it's still more important to have them lean and healthy. They're still going to get better performance in the long run than it is kind of sliding down sort of like a much more gentle grade, still using crappy food and bad eating practices. So I think to some degree it's like tear the Band-Aid off, deal with it, get it done. But obviously personalities are different. Some people may just need to sneak up on this. Like we have our whole meat and nuts breakfast, where we try to get people to just tackle breakfast for 1 week, and then breakfast and lunch, breakfast, lunch, dinner, breakfast, lunch, dinner, snack, with each one of those transitions being about a 1 week of working at the previous level. That can work too, but I kind of like seeing folks jump in and really get it all done.
Yeah, and I think, you know, your point about personality is well taken. I think that's a critical dimension to consider, although often challenging when you're working with someone new. And then generally, you know, my thoughts are the sicker the person is, the quicker we want to get this transition going, although it may be a bit more painful for them as opposed to, you know, someone that's generally a little fitter and eats a pretty clean lifestyle.
Yeah, and if you're, you know, the way you feed and water yourself is training, then you want to get people results, and you want to get them results in a timely manner. And so if that's the case, then you may just need to draw some lines in the sand and be like, hey, if you're going to work with me, you know, these are the parameters, this is what we're going to do. The reason why I'm holding your feet to the fire on this is that we want to see some legitimate results, and you can see the power of the program we're doing. So that, you know, that's another point too. You got to love people enough to like put your foot in their ass and it really encourage them to do it, because then they can really see how it's going to go. And it's not like you're selling the undercoat to a car or something like that. Like, you're selling people their health and wellness. So I think pumping their knee pretty vigorously to get some compliance is always good in that regard.
Absolutely. Cool. All right, so the next two questions are related, and I think these are good questions related to nut intake, so following up on some of our early discussions. So Margo from Red Bluff says, we suggested subbing out nuts for avocado, but unfortunately they aren't in season year-round, or we suggested using Coconut, which she comments, only has so many uses, which I disagree. You can put coconut on everything. But anyway, so for clarification, is the goal here to sub with something that has less saturated fat, although obviously the coconut would be medium chain saturated, or is it just to get away from the nuts regardless of what you sub for it?
Yeah, and Margot is confusing the omega-6, omega-3, omega-6 problems inherent in nuts with a saturated fat problem. So the real issue with consuming nuts that I think we've seen observationally here is that nuts generally, almonds, pecans, except for like walnuts and macadamias, most nuts are very, very heavy in omega-6. Then if you have somebody following a kind of paleo zone diet, particularly if it's zone because people are really keeping an eye on their fat intake, they tend to just eat nuts as like one of their primary fat sources, which isn't the worst thing in the world, other than it can significantly skew your omega-3, omega-6 balance, which we're already fighting that because of grain-fed meat and all the rest of that stuff. So this is the suggestion of stuff like avocado and coconut and some things like that. Even olive oil is a 10% omega-6 fat, the linoleic acid. So I always forget linoleic, alpha-linoleic acid, so it must be linolenic acid. So the short chain omega-6 is found in pretty high amounts in even olive oil, less as a percentage than what you would see in most nuts. But if you have people who are still having problems with getting lean, with systemic inflammation, different things like that, then this is another step in refinement that you can do, trying to shift more of your fats into things like pastured dairy, like the butter, coconut, and just anything along that line, avocado, some of these fat sources that really have no omega-6 fats in them at all.
Yeah, and I think just to piggyback on that also, you know, we've seen anecdotally a fair amount of gut irritation with some folks, continued acne with high nut intakes. And so in general, I think in a lot of cases, we're suggesting folks just take it out and try it and see if they feel better. Because in a lot of cases, we find they do, just from a simple, they run leaner, you know, their skin may look a little better. And so, you know, just something to give it a shot, really.
Yeah, it's that same deal, you know, give it a whirl, give it a month, and then check how you look, feel, and perform. And if it's not working for you, if you're not seeing benefit and it's like complicating your life, then by all means, change it. But we're noticing some people benefiting from shifting some of their fat sources around that way. If you had a Katie DeLuca in your gym like we do, then you could just buy pastured pork products and just eat bacon grease. But that not everybody has that. So
yes, we love legit bacon grease.
Really, truly, especially at NorCal. So
absolutely. And then Randy has a question on the blog that's kind of a related question. So he says he was curious that you mentioned taking in less nuts and using more things like avocado and olive oil. Are you implying taking straight shots of olive oil? If so, how well does one's body absorb straight oil? Would it be good to avoid nut oils, such as times when eating 100 nuts per meal just gets old, and it would be more convenient and efficient to use oils as another fat option along with coconut milk?
So, I mean, I've definitely swigged olive oil before when I've been in a hurry. Obviously, you just want to throw that in with a meal. That's when you're going to get the best digestion on it. Wellborn does this a lot. Is it the best thing in the world to do? I don't know. The Sardinians actually drink a glass of olive oil for breakfast and are some of the most long-lived people on the planet. That would be a really hard thing for me to do. But the coconut milk, by contrast, I can chug that down pretty well. So your body will absorb it if you eat it with a meal. I'm not sure where the rest of Randy's question is here. It's a little vague for me. I think, again, just getting a diversity of fat, really, really like coconut a bunch, avocado, obviously, when it's in season, all that sort of jive.
Yeah, and I think we'll kind of hit a little bit what Randy was talking about on the next question, too, from Paul. So Paul says, we talked a little bit about acne with excessive nut eaters, but didn't say much more than the word acne. Can we expand on this?
Yeah, the omega-3, omega-6 balance, again, the omega-3, omega-6s play into eicosanoid production. The eicosanoid production is feeds into prostaglandins and all the inflammatory stuff that we produce in our body, both good and bad. And there's a product, epithelial growth factor, and which is released by dairy, but the omega-3 omega-6 balances can influence this too. Essentially, acne is kind of a sign of pro-inflammation. There's too much inflammation going on, and this can be insulin levels, epithelial growth factor levels. It can be omega-3, omega-6 imbalances. Occasionally, in females, and I talked to James Fitzgerald about this, maybe about one female in 50, one female in 60, you start putting them on fish oil, omega-3s, and they will actually get acne. And so we need to dial those folks back, and usually those folks end up needing a little bit of GLA, some gamma-linolenic acid, so that they actually need a propping up of one of the intermediaries of the omega-6 pathway. So, it very dependent on what the person has going on, but generally that acne is a sign of inflammation, most typically from too much omega-6, but in some rare individuals, certain females typically, they actually need a little bit of the intermediate chain omega-6 to balance out some other stuff upstream.
Yeah, and Paul goes on to say he eats his predominantly paleo zone diet. He slips in some extra nuts and butter. He kicked dairy a few months ago, thinking it was causing his acne, but he's still breaking out. He thinks he's going to try to wean back on the nuts, or is it something I should completely remove from my diet? And I think what we would start with is try removing it completely and see what happens.
Yeah, totally. Just give it a whirl. That elimination approach is just money to me. You know, you can do all kinds of diagnostic work, but the gold standard is like, do you pull it out? Do you look, feel, perform better? Reintroduce it? Do you look, feel, and perform worse? Done. You know, you don't need any diagnostic data to other than that. That's plenty.
Yeah. And I support fully, Rob, drinking straight olive oil. You just need to have the right kind.
Yeah, the better quality stuff is what you need. It's got a little acid load to it. Totally.
Yeah. All right, great. And we're going to move on to another blog question. This one's from Julianne, and this is kind of a mouthful, so I'll do my best to kind of read this, and then we can kind of hit each of the questions. She says, "Hi, Rob. I notice you frequently talk about insulin spiking properties of different foods and has also seen some of the info you're talking about with respect to dairy and insulin spiking. She notices she gets hungry really quickly after eating yogurt, for example." Not that she's eating yogurt anymore, though. She wanted to let us know. "So the other issue I notice with myself and some clients is getting the carb amount at the meal right. If I have too little carbs at a meal, I have this nagging hunger as my blood sugar is not up to a point that I feel just right at. I've noticed that I want to keep eating to get that just right feeling. One thing I notice about the zone amount of carbs at a meal is that I get the feeling that I've had the right amount of carbs, but not too much. Usually what works is a balance of quick release carbs like a little pumpkin or sweet potato or fruit, plus a lot of non-starch veggies. That way I feel just right, but also don't eat the wrong carbs or proteins that cause an insulin spike. On the other hand, just eating non-starchy veggie carbs leads to quicker fat loss, but I have to wait about half an hour after a meal before I feel my blood sugar has gone up enough." All right, so let's pause there. Any thoughts on that?
It's sounding to me like there's just a little bit of insulin resistance happening here. This reminds me of my mom when I've just, beat my head against the wall trying to help her. God love her, but she's type 2 diabetic, and it's almost like somebody carrying an oxygen canister around in which she needs to, breathe out of the oxygen canister. In this situation, you have somebody that needs to dose their fueling very, very precisely based on what their kind of metabolic machinery is wired at. And I my gut sense here is that she's probably insulin resistant and therefore is not able to access some body fat for energy, is not able to get normal kind of glucagon or liver-mediated glucose release to regulate her blood glucose levels between meals. And so this is why she needs to so precisely dose this stuff. You could also look at it differently and just say she's real wired into what's working for her body. But for me, I would like to see someone who's a little more dynamic than this. They've got a little bit more robustness in them than having to just eat this exactly specifically proportioned meal. Now, that said, a big bowl of fruit is going to put me to sleep. So I don't really have spectacular response to carbohydrates, but I think that's more the norm than not. What I would like to see is somebody able to eat like a protein fat meal with some veggies and just be like stellar from it. So there's probably some adaptation that just needs to happen there.
Yeah, because generally I think what we see is that you don't need to be this precise after most of our meals to feel healthy, energized, you know, be able to do all your normal activities.
Exactly. Yeah, totally.
She goes on to say that she's noticed that some women in particular, slimmer pear shapes, don't tolerate lower carbs. Atkins, for example, makes them feel terrible, not energized. She'd be interested to hear if this is also your experience.
Can't say I've really observed that. No, haven't really observed. But, you know, the thing again is like it when people say they feel terrible and they're not energized, we go back to the article that I did on the zone and athletic performance, and we look at the adaptation period that is necessary to getting into a lower carb diet and being okay with that. You may in fact feel horrible for, you know, two to three weeks. So this doesn't really tell me anything. You know, it's like I need a good month of following the person. And if after a month, the person is still not really doing well on a lower carb approach, then obviously it's kind of like, okay, this person is just very, very insulin sensitive naturally, and they're going to do better on a higher carbohydrate intake. Pollockin, when I was at the Biosignature course, he said that that's probably about 15 to 20% of people. And these are people who are already naturally just kind of jacked. Like they're lean, they're muscular, they tend to do well, you know, they've just kind of intuitively done well on all that stuff and have never really been super tight on their nutrition. They seem to have a little bit more headroom with regards to that.
Yeah, and this reminds me of, I heard Cassandra Forsythe talk once, and you know, she worked with Dr. Jeff Volek at UConn doing a bunch of the low-carb studies, and I recall her talking one study in particular, and I can't remember how many subjects were in there, but you know, it was low-carb, it was, you know, 12 weeks adaptation period, et cetera, and she said, you know, they had, you know, one or two outliers that just did really bad on the low-carb approach. Even after 12 weeks, they felt like crap. They didn't perform well. And, you know, her observation was most of them tended to be, they were already very lean. You know, they tended to have really high activity levels. And she said, you know, they were pretty surprised. That's not what they were expecting. But she was like, you know, we gave them long enough time to adapt. We monitored their diet. We don't believe they were cheating. She just said they were one of those folks where it just didn't work really well for them.
Right, right.
Okay. She goes on to say, in her nutrition studies a couple years ago, we were given this paper with regards to fat loss on either a higher carb or lower carb diet in women. Some lost weight better on higher carb, some on lower carb, depending on whether they were high insulin secretors or low. And she goes on to quote the study and says, a low glycemic low diet facilitates greater weight loss in overweight adults with high insulin secretion, but not in overweight adults with low insulin secretion in the calorie trial.
Yeah, I have not dug through this trial yet. What I would really like to see is what's the diagnostic data that they or studies that they did to determine what is high insulin secretor and what is low insulin secretor even mean? Like, what is their quantifiable measures for all that? Another thing that I would want to look at, we know from things like the Catawba studies and whatnot, that people can have a relatively high carbohydrate intake, but not from grain sources, and probably manage things better. So we've got better leptin and better ghrelin management and all that on the kind of neurohormones. So there's some stuff that I would really want to dig deeper on this to know, okay, yeah, this is legit or no. People were just kind of stacking the deck here. I mean, on the surface, it's like, yeah, okay, low insulin secretors or high insulin secretors, people who eat a meal and produce a bunch of insulin would intuitively do well on a lower glycemic load diet. But then the question is, why is there a difference between people? Some people are high insulin secretors, some people are low insulin secretors. And so that's kind of my thought about like the Catawba stuff. Like, are some people more, are they having like an autoimmune deal from grains or something like that? So what is explaining the differences between these two people or groups of people? Was her body mass index counted for? Like, I just don't see anything like that. On an intuitive level, it kind of makes sense. Okay, if you produce a bunch of insulin in response to food, then maybe you should have lower glycemic load meals, but it still isn't really answering all that much stuff for me.
Yeah, and I think in general, our experience is that the lower carb approach tends to work better for the majority of folks. But I certainly think there are outliers to that, and you know, I think that's just a fact of life.
Yeah, yeah.
So, all right, good answer. So, Rob, I think that's all the questions we have for today. Unless you have anything else insightful you'd like to share with the world.
Dude, I am just full of crap, so I have nothing insightful to share.
All right. Well, with that, I think that ends episode 5. Apologize for the technical difficulties. We will talk to the cable company about do not mess with Rob's internet when we're recording the podcast, because these things are important.
That was weird. We literally have never had our internet go down, and that was just, you know, like a 5-minute deal, and it went down. So, yeah, sorry about that, folks.
Well, maybe Keystone the Cat is unhappy with the amount of attention you've been paying to him, and you need to give him some love.
Well, he's sitting in my lap right now, so hopefully I'm making up for it a little bit, but I'll be on the road significantly less for the foreseeable future, so we'll try to make amends with the cat.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Rob, for your time, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Andy.
All right, see ya.